From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when you made lunch plans with your friend. Where do you want to go, you asked, and the answer sounded something like this. Well, I'm doing keto now, so I have some ideas. Well, some of the best-selling diet books in recent months and years have focused on keto, which typically restricts carbs to less than 10% of calories, limits proteins to 20%, with fat taking up the rest. The fans of keto are legion and loud, from celebrities to your Facebook friends, many people touting the benefits of keto. Try keto. You must do keto. Keto. Did you hear Jared Leto or Beto and Reno? They're all about keto. Well, proponents say a ketogenic diet forces the body to primarily burn fat while producing ketones. Is that a good thing? Can it really help with type 2 diabetes? Are there clinical uses? As the New York Times recently noted, there have been plenty of studies, but most of the studies are small and with short duration. Some larger, longer studies are underway, but not done yet. Many doctors are skeptical, and some are now publicly expressing concern. They talk about the emphasis on saturated fats, for example, and a concern about heart disease and other related risks. Well, this hour, we try to have a sober conversation about keto. What is it? When should we try it? Should we try it? What should we know about it? And what are the alternatives? Our guests this hour include in studio Jill Chodak, a clinical dietitian with the Center for Community Health and Prevention at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Leslie Fisher, a registered dietitian with Rochester Regional Health. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And also with us on the line is Dr. Steve Cook, an associate professor of pediatrics at Golisano Children's Hospital. Dr. Cook, welcome. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks so much.
Well, I'm gonna start with Jill on this because I want to start sort of broad, and then we're going to get specific because I know there's a lot of specific questions about keto, and people may have them. Listeners, you can share your thoughts on keto as we go throughout the hour if you want to call or email the program, connections@wxxi.org, to email connections@wxxi.org. You can call 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Jill, keto in general, are you happy to see the prominence, or do you think there's some things you'd like to address with that? How do you view keto?
Well, I think it's important to set the stage first with a judgment-free zone here for me. I'm not coming on to kind of attack keto because I know it can be very divisive. I want to acknowledge as a clinician that we do have ketogenic dietitians at URMC who it's their sole purpose to utilize ketogenic diet in a clinical realm, and its efficacy is well known in the science related field. And so it's utilized for epilepsy and preventing seizures in both pediatric and adult patients. It also has been known to be effective in cancer treatment in kind of slowing the growth of tumors, and we don't know what it can do yet. So in the clinical realm, I want to set the stage there and say that, yes, it can be useful, and we do use it already clinically for those things. Where I tend to have pause is that I think right now it's become a fad diet where some folks might be recklessly jumping into something without actually knowing how it can negatively impact their health. And so I'm just kind of here to be curious about, or to encourage curiosity in folks to know more about what they're eating, what they're putting in their mouth, what they might be doing to negatively impact their health. Because maybe it could work for them, maybe it might not. But I would hate to see someone jump into a diet that's restrictive and then cause harm rather than good.
All right. And we'll talk about what harm she's talking about, or what in general their concerns are. But real quick, Jill, when you hear people talk keto, you assume they mean what? What's the definition?
It's traditionally a low carbohydrate, high fat, kind of medium amount of protein diet. So those are the three macronutrients that are found in our foods. And so we can manipulate the proportion in which they're in our diet to impact change in the body.
So if you're at 10% carbs, 20% protein, the rest fat, so roughly 70% fat, how much does that differ with, and this is an impossible question because what are we all eating? But for people who are not on any sort of a fad diet, I mean, what do we kind of guess that a normal day would look like?
Well, so the standard range that we would recommend for a person without clinical conditions for normal carbohydrate intake would be 45 to 65% of your daily calories from carbohydrate.
Whoa.
So if you think about 10% or that's a a very, very big difference. And there are modified keto. You can vary the amount of grams, but it's a big, big difference. Same thing with fat. You know, we want to max out at about 35% of our daily calories from fat, if that's the standard range. So if you look at a ketogenic diet, it's very, very different.
Okay. Leslie, how do you feel about what you've heard about keto in the public eye? And let's get outside of clinical use, but stick with what we're seeing in terms of promoted for everybody. How do you feel about keto?
I think that keto can work for some people. Everybody's very individualized in their nutrition. I think that keto has gained a lot of popularity, very similar to a fad diet. My concern comes in with the keto diet when, or any diet that I have a patient on that eliminates a food group. I think that it's really important to work with each person individually to figure out what range works best for them.
Dr. Cook, how do you feel about what you've seen with the rise of keto?
It's very concerning, but not surprising. I mean, we've done this throughout the history of man in terms of having fad diets and people getting up and exclaiming them. I think it's just more concerning now because of the unfiltered information that people can find on the internet or, you know, through social media, that it gets spread very quickly. And especially when thinking of children and pediatric patients, not really tested, with the exception of what Jill pointed out in terms of children and adults with epilepsy in very specific controlled settings. So I have a lot of concern, but I'm not surprised because we cycled different types of diets for years, whether it's high fat, low fat, high carb, high protein. So, not too surprised in that sense.
But Steve, why are we sort of constantly looking for what you rightly call a fad diet, but we seem to be looking for some kind of a silver bullet that would be the big change as opposed to what we already know about typical nutrition? Why do you think that is, Steve?
Well, because that's how our society has geared ourselves for. We've increasingly pushed toward the silver bullet, the simple answer, the easy out. And the reality is that the science behind obesity and how the body accrues fat and accumulates fat is far more complicated than just eat less, move more. There is a very complex biology, and I think your guests can also attest, some people do better on certain dietary patterns. They're able to either stick to it better, they get better response, and that tells us there's a lot of genetic underpinning of how our body accumulates weight, and the problem is that we don't want to both look at it from a hard work standpoint, but we also don't look at it or invest in it from a healthcare system model. And I'm not saying every person with high body fat has the disease obesity, but for those people who are suffering with weight-related complications or nutritional complications, it's far more complicated than just eat this or that.
So, Dr. Cook, when it comes to kids, you know, as a pediatrician, if someone says to you, I love keto. It's working for me. I'm putting my kids on keto. What do you generally say to that?
I tell them we don't know how much damage it could actually do to children. It's been used only in children with epilepsy and very closely monitored. And to do that is really kind of, taking some risk because you don't know. And a growing child, a growing body, a growing brain is a lot more susceptible both to benefit but also to harm of something. So if a child not getting enough carbohydrate at a certain point in growth, is that going to affect how their brain develops, their heart, their lungs, other organs that may be very critical because we don't do studies in children in very detail around these types of health questions. Just like we've unfortunately learned that lead, even small amounts, is extremely dangerous to the brain of an infant and a toddler. How we're changing the nutrients and consumption of children as they're growing cannot be taken lightly.
Okay. Now, Jill, I saw you nodding with some of the concerns there. Let's talk about an adult population. When you talk about possible harm or unknown harm, we reference the fact that there are studies that are happening now that are going to be broader that will tell us more once we got more information. And everybody wants the biggest sample size possible and the most information possible. What are your biggest concerns? We're not talking individual patient, so nobody who's listening who's doing keto right now, Jill's not saying this is going to definitely happen to you, but generally speaking, what are your biggest concerns with keto?
Well, so in the clinical setting, just to start a person on the ketogenic diet, we would test a whole host of labs, like at least a dozen, to size up where the person's at as far as nutrient storage or their LDL cholesterol or fat-soluble vitamins, things like that. And then they would have an entire team dedicated to making sure that there are no micronutrient deficiencies going on as this restriction happens. And so for me, my biggest concern, honestly, with what I see in my clinics is the LDL cholesterol and cardiovascular disease risk. So, you know, it goes back to, okay, the ketogenic diet can help you drop weight quickly. Like, that's why I think it sells so well. It can help you drop weight quickly because it's burning fat in absence of carbohydrate. However, at what cost is the biggest concern for me? We want to make sure we're thinking about our long-term health, our overall health, and our whole health aside from weight loss. So it goes back to that wellness culture that we talk about. And so if you think about changing those three macronutrients we described earlier, carbohydrate, protein, and fat, if you have one in excess and another, you know, in absence, then what are you doing inside your body? You're increasing your fat, which means that you're increasing the saturated fat intake, which therefore can increase the LDL cholesterol in your body, which can increase plaque, which can then make you more susceptible to cardiovascular disease. So these are the things we think about as clinicians when we hear ketogenic diet. And so we hope, or I hope, that you're thinking about that too before you jump onto this diet. And some folks might not think about that. So encouraging folks to be proactive about their overall health before they jump into something that they think is harmless for weight loss and in fact could increase their cardiovascular risk exponentially.
Okay. Leslie, mm-hmm. What worries you the most?
I think I also want to touch on the mental health risk that it brings about. Is you're going on this diet, you're eliminating this, you know, macronutrient that we need, and it sets you up for failure, that you're going to deprive yourself of this for a certain amount of time and then end up, you know, binging on this food. And if you lost weight, you're going to regain the weight, and then you're going to have feelings of failure. And I just think that sets people up to be in this like endless cycle of fad dieting and weight gain and weight loss and regain.
So let's start to work through some listener questions. And Tim wants to know, how does keto work when it comes to weight loss? Now, Jill, you just mentioned fat burning. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of people, okay, I'm going to put my hand in the air and say, I didn't study the way the body works. And if you're telling me my diet would be 70% fat, I would first assume I'm going to gain weight. With keto, the idea is if you do that, you can lose weight. Why?
Okay, so it's complicated. I'm going to try and break it down simple. And so basically, glucose is the main substrate that our brain relies on for fuel. And that's during a fed state. So when we eat, our body, the nutrients go in, insulin is secreted from our pancreas, and we have this response. In absence of glucose or carbohydrate, our body has alternative fuel sources, so protein and fat. Protein can be turned into glucose and sent to our brain and used as fuel. Fat cannot. It can be burned as fuel, but it can't be turned into glucose and sent to the brain. So we have this byproduct, because our body is so beautiful and can adapt, called ketones, which is why it's called the ketogenic diet, where when you burn fat for fuel, which obviously if you burn fat, you lose weight because fat's pretty dense, you get these ketones. And so there's a state of ketosis that people who are on the ketogenic diet describe, where it's this kind of fine line that you walk, where you're producing these ketones, you can use them as fuel, you're kind of walking that line because they're acids. So we see patients who are admitted to the hospital with diabetic ketoacidosis. So these are acids. If you pass this line, this boundary, these acidic ketones can turn your blood acidic and essentially cause all these other problems. And so you basically, in a nutshell, you can burn fat for fuel, but in absence of carbohydrate, the byproducts of fat metabolism can produce negative effects, which then you have to deal with.
Okay. And so is it then logical to wonder that if keto is working in a short-term way for someone who's using it, is it logical to wonder if there's going to be a long-term impact? Even if, let's say someone tries, quote-unquote, tries keto, and they drop 20 pounds, and they say they feel good, there's still a concern that long-term you're going to have some adverse effects that are not going to manifest now.
Correct, because you're telling your body you're in a fasted state. So that's kind of why we're exploring the science behind using it for diabetes or people who have insulin resistance, because you are not ingesting as many carbohydrates, you're not producing the insulin spike and the glucose spike in your body, so therefore the response is different. So we've been playing around with that to see if that can have a positive effect without sacrificing, like, we want to fuel your brain, essentially. So we're trying to do that dance to fuel your brain, give it the glucose that it needs or the substrate that it needs, while also mitigating this other response. So we don't know if that has a positive or negative effect.
So let's do a couple of things. And I want to start with Dr. Cook, but I want all three of you to address this. Because as Jill has said, Dr. Cook, certainly in the medical profession, you want to be careful not to shame people and not to sort of deride their choices in a way that makes them shut down, because there's a psychology aspect to what we eat and how we feel about ourselves. But how direct are you? If someone says to you, Doc, I'm going to do keto, you say to them, don't, or you say, okay, but, or you say what? What do you say, Dr. Cook?
I try to get back at what it is they're trying to do and get back at really their motivations and behaviors. It was pointed out before by Leslie, I think, in terms of thinking of, you know, how concerned are they, and pointing out that, you know, this can have a short-term effect, but, you know, the long-term and sustainability is very difficult, and I don't want to put you down a path of some quick return, but then difficulty to maintain and make it worse, and hopefully reason with them to understand, you know, first of all, you know, what is the behavior pattern? Because you could substitute out, Doc, I'm going to try keto. Doc, I'm going to try Weight Watchers. I'm going to try paleo. You know, just substitute whatever fad you want in there. And that's the bigger thing we need to communicate with. And then on top of it, assessing what specific type of medical risks may be greater for them, given a specific type of dietary approach. You know, one of the other things that has come out of research looking at some of these diets is looking at brain hormones. And again, this gets to the biology of obesity. Ghrelin is a hormone related to appetite in the brain. And what we've learned is one of the things ketones do is they suppress that. So not only do you burn an alternative fuel, but it suppresses part of your hunger drive when you get to higher levels. So that's another advantage, perhaps, of this type of diet. But it comes at a cost, and it may come at a steep cost for people who are going to be more susceptible to complications related to this type of diet, as well as just, you know, really trying to maintain, maintaining a healthy balance.
Okay. Leslie, I'm in clinic with you, and I say to you, I think I'm going to do keto.
Okay.
And you say?
I, very similar to Dr. Cook, what's your reason? What's your end goal? And try to work with you to come up with something that's more sustainable, something that we can work with long term and not have some of the ramifications that the keto diet might have.
All right. Jill, I want you to actually role play this with me. We're in clinic. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
I want to hear exactly how you would do this with one of your patients in clinic. Hey, I've been really struggling with cutting these last 25 pounds that I want to cut. And, you know, I'm really busy, and I've got a friend who tried keto, and I'm going to do it. What do you think?
I want to know why. I want to know what support you have. I want to know.
Because I want to lose that last 25, and I heard from somebody that it works.
Is that the most important health goal for you right now?
Well, I want to look tight.
Okay. What if I told you that there were other options out there for you?
But I feel like I've tried. I feel like I've tried so many things. And, you know, I'm either on the wagon or off the wagon, or it's been a struggle. And I feel like the way people are talking about this, that this is different.
It's exhausting. It's exhausting, isn't it?
Yes.
It is. And so how do we come up with a plan together that can take that away for you and still get you what you need?
So is keto a bad idea?
Haven't decided. What do you think?
All right. We'll play over. So I see what you're doing. You're trying to get the patient to come to a conclusion on their own without you sort of telling them that this is bad, good. I know there's certain words that you think are a little more like anvils as opposed to.
Yeah, I would just say, like, it's not about me, honestly. It's not about me or what I think. I have clinical judgment. I know the science. I study the science. I just want what's right for the patient and what will promote their health and happiness. That's literally all I want. And so when I hear folks who come into my clinic who say, I want to do keto, I get curious and not judgmental. And it's like, okay, some folks, maybe it's the stepping stone they need to catapult them into weight loss. So I do have folks who do keto, and it's supervised, and we've done their lipids. We've done all these panels. We do the supplementation, and it works for them. And in 2 months after they've lost however much weight, then we work on a goal and a plan to re-implement carbohydrates and teach them how to cook and teach them how to balance their plate. So look, it is what the patient makes it. All I'm asking for, all I'm begging for, honestly, at this point, is for folks to not just jump into something without actually pausing and saying, why am I doing this? What is the picture of my health? What are my lipids at this point? Honestly, that's like one of the first things I say. And what's my long-term goal here? Because it's not just a day-to-day, oh, I'm going to eat this eggs and bacon and then go on my merry way. It's about a full day of eating, a lifetime of health. What does that look like to me?
So let me start to work through some listener feedback. As we talk about keto, and listeners, if you've got questions about the keto diet, maybe you've tried it, maybe you're on it, maybe you're not, maybe you've heard about it, or if you want to just talk about building an effective eating regime in your own life, you can call the program toll-free. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. It's 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. Jason writes to say, are fad diets even a new thing? I'm thinking of the fad eating trends of the 19th century associated with people like Graham and Kellogg. It seems human nature hasn't changed much in 150 years. It's from Jason. You're probably right, Jason. I mean, it probably is not just a new marketing thing. Steve wants to know, he says he is a fan of Jordan Peterson, who apparently is eating only meat. Steve writes that Jordan Peterson and his daughter literally only eat meat for their entire diet, and they claim to be fully healthy and fit. So I wonder if Emma Ray or Megan Mack can do me a little Googling and see if Jordan Peterson is actually only eating meat, he and his daughter. But what would how would you feel? All right, I'll start with Jill on this. So somebody comes in and says, I'm trying this new Jordan Peterson diet. It's 100% meat.
Okay. Well, honestly, the first question, and I have a 7-year-old, so this is the first question that pops in my head. How are you pooping? Like, are you pooping? Like, how is that moving through you? Honestly, that's like the first thing that comes to my mind, because fiber is such an essential nutrient for gut health and mental health tied with gut health and also pooping. And so I'm thinking, I don't know how they're getting away with it, to be honest. And then my second like notion is, okay, and then where are we getting all the valuable micronutrients that are coming from all the plant-based foods?
Okay, mm-hmm. So you'd have concerns.
I would definitely have
fair
concerns.
To say.
Yes.
Would you, Leslie, have concerns? 100%
yeah,
meat.
Absolutely. especially as a cardiovascular dietitian, I think I would be very concerned. I think that's a great point. And also, we need those fruits and vegetables for all the minerals and vitamins that we get from them.
Well, according to the Atlantic Monthly, Steve's email is correct. The famous psychologist and his daughter swear by a regimen of eating only beef, and they are telling all of their followers to do the same. Dr. Cook, if someone came in and said, I'm not on keto, I'm on 100% beef, what would you say?
Yeah, this is the pediatrician. I'm wondering about their bowel habits as well. So it's a big concern, but it's, you know, it's crazy. The history of fad diets, I remember seeing this before, traced back to Lord Byron, the poet. In the 1820s, was on a water and vinegar diet, and as a well-known poet, was kind of a celebrity dieter. So, I mean, we've gone through cycles of these, and it's just insane how much information gets out there so quickly of these behaviors. And it really is sad because people are spending good money on this and really wasting resources and energy on it. I have a lot of concerns because it's just not how we're meant to eat as people.
I mean, like, there's something that makes me wonder, given who Jordan Peterson is, very smart guy, but maybe he's, like, so determined to thumb his nose at vegans that he's like, I'm going to eat only beef, and look what's, I don't know, I cannot get my head around the psychology of eating only beef. But again, listeners, we're trying not to judge. We're working really hard not to be judgmental. And if you want to share your questions, you can do that. Connections@WXXI.org. Judy writes and says, I realized I would have to do the hard work in order to lose weight. It took willpower. I ate everything I wanted. I like bread. I like food. I refused to eliminate any group of food while changing my eating habits. I stayed as close to 1,200 calories a day and kept a food diary and corrected my eating as I got close to the 1,200 calorie limit. In doing so, I decreased my alcohol intake significantly, as I like beer. I started this a year ago and am vigilant of my daily food intake to this day. I also walk or hike for about an hour almost daily. That's from Judy. I do want to ask if that 1,200 number stands out. Jill, is that a number that we should be targeting?
That's a great question. It kind of stood out to me, too. Without knowing her, I don't know. I have seen my fair share of folks who have actually had weight gain because of overtly restrictive caloric intake. So if you don't eat enough calories, and this goes kind of back to the keto realm and the fed versus fasted state. So if you're starving yourself, and I don't know if she is, I'm not saying that, but if you are not getting enough calories per day, your body then goes into kind of a pseudo-starved state where it's going to keep everything because it thinks you're starving. So you might actually be doing yourself a disservice because you're slowing down your metabolism, you're slowing down your thyroid, you're holding on to all those nutrients and fats because your body is convinced that you are not going to have adequate food. So I am always hesitant to either count calories or restrict calories because of that reason. So without knowing Judy, I wouldn't speak to that specific thing, but that's kind of my thoughts on that matter.
Generally speaking, yeah. That would be your concern. Leslie, what do you think?
I think there's some great aspects that she said. You know, she's changed her diet for better. She's cut out alcohol. She's exercising. Those all sound like great things. I really hesitate to put any kind of number or caloric restriction on a diet. For me, it's more about having variety and a mix of everything. So the 1,200 does, it scares me. It sounds like a very low number. I don't know her. She might be a very small woman, but I think the good thing is she's getting the variety, but yeah.
Okay. Dr. Cook, what do you think?
I agree with your guess. This is a low number that, you have to be concerned with. I would point out that, you know, the biology around weight loss, if this is what we're talking about, and the science around the medicine has come a long way. We have evidence-based interventions for people of various weight and complication standards, and we have to look at that because someone who maybe wants to lose 10 or 20 pounds may not have any medical problems related to their weight and may not need to do that versus someone who, you know, maybe 50 to 100 pounds in excess weight, they need to be afforded an opportunity to be involved in a real meaningful weight loss intervention, whether that involves a medication as well as lifestyle change and even possibly surgery, which are all evidence-based effective interventions.
That is going to be an important question after our only break of the hour here. How do you know if you need to lose weight? A lot of people think they do. And it's one thing to say, do you want to? You heard our guests in studio saying they talked to their patients about what are your goals here? What do you want? But then it's a different thing to say, I need to lose weight. Well, how do we know? And how do we start working towards that process of figuring that out? Because a lot of people who do keto are doing it because they think they have to, or they think they need to lose weight, and they're hearing that keto works here. Our guests are offering some real caution about keto. Not to say they're judging anybody who's on it, but they're offering the facts and what we do know and evidence about what keto does for and to the body. And if you've got comments or questions about your own eating, your efforts to lose weight, keto or otherwise, you can continue with emails, connections@wxxi.org. You can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester. 263-9994. Dr. Steve Cook is on the line with us, an associate professor of pediatrics at Golisano Children's Hospital. Leslie Fisher, a registered dietitian with Rochester Regional Health. Jill Chodak, a clinical dietitian with the Center for Community Health and Prevention at the University of Rochester Medical Center. And we'll talk about need versus want to lose weight next. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, an irreverent conversation on our communication habits. We will answer this question. How long do you have, based on social etiquette, to respond to a text message or an email or a voice message? Then in our second hour, the great Rue Mapp joins us. She's talking about outdoor education and getting more African Americans outdoors. We'll talk about it on Tuesday. Let's talk about what we need to do for our weight and weight loss, or how we recognize when we need to lose it versus want to lose it. And we're going to talk about us, and we're going to talk about our kids as well. Jill Chodak, let me start with you. If a patient comes to you and says, hey, I need to lose 20 pounds, need to lose it. I'm sure you're going to want to know why they think they need to. How do you identify when you think they actually do need to lose weight versus they would like to lose weight?
So I would say, I mean, and there's a lot of controversy around BMI and body positivity and all that. So I think it's a valid question. So I'm very sensitive to this. I'm very mindful about this topic. So again, in a non-judgmental way, I'll talk about it.
Sure.
And so if a patient comes to me expressing they need to lose weight, I do get to the root of why they feel like they need it. Because sometimes, honestly, even if they do need to lose weight, just simply talking about, okay, weight loss doesn't help solve the problem. If you've been beat up by life being overweight or feeling like you need to lose weight since childhood, me talking about how to lose weight when you've basically tried everything does really nothing to help you. So a lot of times in those cases, it involves supporting the person and saying, okay, I hear you. You really want to lose weight. You may need to lose weight. Where do we start? What does your overall health look like? What's your support system? And where do we go from here? How can we, because it can't change on a dime. It can't change overnight. So me hashing out a meal plan or counting the calories or jumping right into that weight loss really does a disservice to that person. I know that sounds really vague, but I find that that usually promotes the best progress.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What do you say, Leslie?
Yeah, and I honestly never talk about weight loss. I like to focus more on what is your overall lifestyle look like. What are you eating? What's on your plate? How's your exercise? What's your social support, your friend system? I think that talking about weight gain or weight loss and telling somebody they need to lose weight just puts a terrible idea in their head and really puts a negative focus on it when it should be looked at more in the positive light.
And before I bring in Dr. Cook, Leslie, Jill, are we still too hung up on BMI?
It can be used as a valuable biomarker, but I personally don't use it very much.
Okay, Leslie?
I use it in my practice, but it's for a very specific reason. Other than that, I think BMI just creates the stigma, and it's not necessary.
Okay, Dr. Cook, people think about their kids. They think about, what's healthy. And if someone says, well, you know, my kid needs to lose weight, you know, he's 10 and XYZ, what goes through your mind and how do you kind of sort through that conversation on, quote, kids who need to lose weight?
Well, you know, it's very concerning. We've been doing a couple of studies now in the community offering an evidence-based intervention for weight loss for children and adolescents, and we involved a parent. And I can probably count on one hand the number of times we've actually heard from a family, a parent saying, my child needs to lose weight or needs to be, you know, in this type of intervention. Because weight carries with it such a stigma. And in the case of a child and parent, it's very heavy on the parent because it is, you know, it's viewed as a failed parenting strategy. But what you brought up before and what was discussed before, you know, someone whose life has been, you know, they've been beat up by life, that gets at something called ACEs, adverse childhood experiences. And this, again, gets back to the biology of obesity. We know that the more those severe adverse experiences children, young adults experience, especially in early childhood, it not only damages your mental health and how you develop socially, emotionally, it also has a biologic underpinning. And some of the first research around that from Folletti and these other groups on ACEs was in adults in weight loss interventions who had lost weight and then had massive regains. And when they investigated and asked them, they recalled traumatic experiences from childhood, poverty, depression, abuse, physical, sexual abuse, things like that. So again, you know, this is a very complicated condition. It involves a lot of biologic underpinnings. It's not a matter of motivation. So when a parent brings that up, I almost want to ask the parent, what is their goal and what are their purposes? And you're right, using BMI is a very crude tool. It's kind of like, and where we are in medicine is really sad because using BMI to say someone has a disease, obesity, is kind of like saying, oh, you have a tumor, you must have cancer. You know, it's very crude. And we've done a study, some groups in Canada have looked at actually a scale system where you actually stage obesity, and you would use weight, you'd use BMI and waist circumference as a starting point, but then you would stage it based on number of metabolic complications, mechanical complications, mental health complications. And they actually showed that that was a better predictor of adults having cardiovascular events or of just death. And that's probably a better way we should look at addressing weight, is really stage it, because someone, again, may have a high BMI and it's more muscle mass than fat mass, or maybe it is fat, but they're not experiencing other complications of it. Well, there's not really strong evidence showing that is something that's going to be a big predictor of risk in the immediate future. So when it comes to families, because it is really rare, I really want to get into the family and ask what's going on, because there is a lot of mental health issues that can underlie this, and it's a very delicate thing to work through.
All right, let me get to your phone calls. Joan in Henrietta next up. Go ahead, Joan.
Hi. WXXI had this Dr. Ash, I think was his name, who talked, you could get the keto diet information through them. So, and he stressed, and the reason I got the information was he talked about it should help prevent dementia and Alzheimer's. And he talked a lot about it. I haven't heard anything about that on your program today. But also, I tried that diet. There is no way I can do that. So I have all this information if anybody wants it.
Joan, thank you. But let me also say, Joan was mentioning that the information said it would help Alzheimer's and dementia. Jill Chodak, should we be pumping the brakes on that, or what do we know so far?
I think science is still trying to figure that out. I've also seen with dementia and Alzheimer's, we're now linking it to the gut microbiome and gut bacteria in particular. And so there's definitely a connection between the gut and our brain health, obviously. And we're still learning that scope. So it definitely, I could see it down the line being used. I mean, obviously it's used in preventing seizures. So it clearly has an effect on the brain. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see something connecting keto to Alzheimer's and dementia. I haven't seen it yet.
Okay, and what Joan's referring to is a program on PBS with Dr. Josh Axe, A-X-E, Dr. Axe, who I don't know much about, by the way. I mean, I'm just reading off some notes. But Dr. Axe trying to outline benefits of the keto diet beyond fasting and weight loss. Fasting's an interesting word there. But reduced risk for type 2 diabetes, reduced risk of heart disease, resistance to brain and neurological disorders, and more. Is that too broad for you right there? Because he's talking about heart disease, all the things that other doctors I've heard in various places like the New York Times and on this program today raising concerns about. Dr. X was saying is a possible benefit. To me, that screams careful, more research needed. What does that say to you, Jill?
Yeah, well, I think it's a trade-off. It's like there are many things that go into calculating one's cardiovascular risk, weight being one of them, LDL cholesterol being another among the vast spectrum of things we assess. And so that's kind of where I was going with my, I think, initial response about ketogenic diet is that it can be effective. So say you don't have an elevated LDL cholesterol and you don't have a family history of cardiovascular disease and you do have excess weight to lose and you want to lose it fast, maybe that might be considered for you. So you lose weight to decrease your cardiovascular disease risk. Maybe your LDL goes up a little bit, but then you work with a dietitian to get your, keep your weight stable and you decrease your LDL in another way. So it's not necessarily wrong, but it's just it seems misguided and a little bit too vague for my liking.
Okay. Leslie, you want to see more research on this one?
Yeah, I think there is a lot of research right now that's going on with the keto diet and these diseases, but nothing is conclusive yet.
Okay. Dr. Cook, how do you feel about what you heard there?
The one of the most difficult things to study is dietary intake, nutrition. And probably the second hardest thing to study are mental health diseases, because you can't do simple tests. So, an outcome like dementia can, how you define that, it's not like there's a specific blood test, and even, imaging isn't specific for it. Then you have studies around diet. Well, if you look at the studies, it's probably more observational studies, and they looked at, people who ate more of this food had less symptoms of dementia, after 6 years of tracking them versus people who ate other components of food. But there's so many other unmeasured factors that go into that. So sadly, it's again, it's one of these very hard areas to do a study on, and it's usually based on not the strongest of evidence. It's more observation, but not a true research design where there's better control that can account for unmeasured factors.
And what Dr. Cook is saying makes so much sense to me and should to our listeners in a lot of different ways. It goes beyond whether keto is impacting dementia and other disorders. I deal with migraines, and people in medical settings have asked me many times, well, what are you eating? And I'm going, well, you're right. I had an avocado yesterday, but I had 15 other things. And should we talk about that? And it's been very hard to isolate so-called triggers for migraines because of all the variables, whereas sleep and dehydration are classic. That's very easy to trace back. And so it's not that I've given up on food. You don't give up. But what I would love to do that I don't have the time to do is really study long term. I mean, everything you eat for years. And how long have we known that keto is a thing? I haven't heard that term for too many years.
1921.
Ketogenic diets, they were doing
yes,
it? Like the flappers were doing
one.
Keto?
It was, that was when it was first used clinically or quote-unquote discovered clinically.
Okay.
Yeah, so 1921.
So maybe there are bigger, longer studies than I'm aware of. But as the New York Times points out, most of what we talk about when it comes to clinical study of keto is on the shorter, smaller side than clinicians would prefer to see. So that's not to shut it out. And Joan, I'm really glad you called. Thank you for that. Let me go ahead and get an email from Rachel in Canandaigua. She says, as an exercise instructor who has dealt with many overweight people in my classes, I have run across the term adaptive thermogenesis, which I believe refers to the fact that cells that have been fat fight hard to stay that way, making it harder for people attempting to lose weight. In other words, a person who normally weighs 150 pounds can consume more calories daily and maintain their weight versus someone who has dieted down to 150 due to adaptive thermogenesis. How does keto affect this, if at all? Which sounds to be exactly like the old Atkins diet, way too much fat and protein. That's from Rachel. Dr. Cook, I'll start with you. I don't know that term. Have you heard of adaptive thermogenesis, doctor?
Yes, and that's essentially what it is that the body has a set point and a range of a body weight set point, and it fights to defend that set point. And as you gain more weight, it starts to reset that set point. So a person eating a diet who's always been around 150, 160 pounds, it's easier for them to stay there than someone who was weighing 250 or 220 and then got down to 150. The body fights to get back to that set point, that higher weight. So that is driving up appetite, that is shifting fat stores. There's a variety of ways the body responds. And not everyone responds the same way. Some people respond more rapidly. So ketones, again, we know have an effect on some of these brain hormones I'd mentioned before, ghrelin being one of them, that helps with some appetite suppression. So it may contribute in that manner on top of whatever calorie shift is going on. But the problem is maintaining that level of ketosis in terms of your body producing that amount of fuel that then is having a weight suppression effect on your body.
Okay, so but doctor, just let's kind of probe that one point that the emailer makes a little bit more there, because if there is sort of a range that is, for lack of a better term, typical for any given body, and you use the idea of, well, if you're 220 getting down to 150, it's harder to stay at 150 versus someone who sort of is sort of slender and has always been so. I think what I want to ask is, should people who are trying to make that significant weight loss feel discouraged from the outset? Because it sounds like it's going to be harder for them. What's the message for someone who might be 220 and wants to get to 180, 300 and wants to get to 195, whatever the case is, Dr. Cook, what's the message for them knowing that it may be harder to maintain?
Well, it's important to look at really evidence-based strategies to do it, as well as having the right supports around it. So, you know, sadly, we always hear the, oh, I just like to lose 5 or 10 more pounds here. I'd like to lose this or that. That's probably not medically related weight loss. But if you have someone who, you know, maybe weighs 220, but they have high cholesterol, diabetes, they have sleep apnea, they have a number of metabolic complications, they have acid reflux and knee problems, where they will get a benefit of weight. Of weight loss, then you start with an evidence-based approach and you start with a realistic goal, 5 or 10%. And the sad part is that studies from Weight Watchers and other groups for centuries have shown that people have far too big an expectation of a weight loss goal for a lifestyle intervention than a lifestyle alone intervention can achieve. In other words, people have said, oh, I want to lose 80 or 90 pounds. Well, a lifestyle intervention alone, just eating less, exercising more, it's real hard to get to that amount of weight loss. But you could get to 5 or 10% and get a medical benefit, but people don't think, they think that's failure. On the flip side, if they need to lose 80, 90, 100 pounds, then you really do need to engage the medical system and look at strategies that will do that. And that is going to be in addition to a lifestyle intervention.
So, Jill, if you have a patient who says, comes to you and says, I'm on keto, I think it's working for me, and your assessment is, okay, I respect that, but let's talk about some other things. If you've got patients who say, look, I've struggled with so many things and this is just working, how do you deal with the psychology for people who have maybe tried to cut out 20 to 30 pounds and they feel like keto is the ticket for them, when you might be thinking, okay, but there are other options here? How do you work through that?
So it really surrounds cardiovascular disease risk. And I talk about, you know, healthy outside versus healthy inside. So you can enjoy the healthy outside, that weight loss, the things like that. But if your heart isn't healthy, can you really? And so I try to just be mindful of, okay, let's check your lipids, your LDL cholesterol. Let's make sure your heart is in good form so that with this weight loss, you can enjoy the things that you want to do. And what are those things? And then going forward, what does the rest of your life look like? Is this something that you want to sustain, that you can sustain, that you should sustain? And then going forward, what does that look like? I think kind of going back to what we were talking about, that drastic weight loss and how it might be hard to maintain, that's where I kind of do the work where it's like, okay, if you think about losing weight slowly, you're changing your habits, you're changing your lifestyle, you're slowly losing the weight, you're achieving both outside health and inside health. And so you're making this transformational kind of whole body change versus this one drastic physical change that your body's going to fight that might be mentally hard to wrap your brain around. So I try to strive for, I'm more of a big picture gal. I am more of a whole body gal. We can do this weight loss, but let's think about inside both heart and mind.
And Mark wants to know if any of your guests have ever seen a fad diet that truly works and they still recommend. Is there one, Jill Chodak, that you go, yeah, do the Atkins?
That is an excellent question that I have not thought about. Okay. If like right off the bat, I'm going to say that I hold out hope, brace yourself, for intermittent fasting in the correct form. So we're researching it now. And the reason why I say that is not because I'm a fad diet person, you know I'm not, but it seems to go back to the common sense approach of, okay, we've become these habitual snackers, or when we get bored, we eat, or things like that. So in the true sense of the form, if I'm picking like an 8 or 12 hour window where I'm eating and I'm having three meals and I'm choosing a Mediterranean style diet, which is what the true intermittent fasting was designed to do, it actually mimics like back in the days when you were out farming or whatever. I would say if I gravitate toward any quote unquote fad diet, I gravitate toward that not because it's anything other than kind of more of that intuitive where we came from type of eating.
Okay, Leslie.
I mean, I really agree with what you have to say. I don't know a whole lot about intermittent fasting, so I can't say that I would possibly suggest that diet. I mean, if you want to call the Mediterranean diet a fad diet, I endorse that, and I tell people if you want to change your eating, you know, read some information about the Mediterranean diet or talk to them about it. But as far as like the diets that you're going to look up blog recipes online and I will never endorse one of those.
Dr. Cook, I assume it's South Beach for you.
Well, you know, you just saw right through me. But, I mean, I would argue that a little bit of what Jill was just describing, intermittent fasting, that's probably how we ate in this country anyway 40, 50 years ago, before so much technology and before food was so accessible. You know, you had some breakfast, maybe had lunch, skipped lunch, had a small meal. You know, in this country, it seems like we're snacking every couple hours. So I really don't hold out much hope for many fad diets as much as, you know, a whole lifestyle, whole family type of approach. And when needed, evidence-based interventions on top of that. And, you know, we have this intervention that involves parent and child together that we see both child and parent lose weight. And I'm not seeing any adult studies that show any of these adult interventions that show that same direction, that if a mother does this diet or approach or intervention, the child loses weight. Yeah. And, you know, I think that is what we're getting at in our intervention, that it's more of parenting strategies and family lifestyle and behaviors and not just fad diet. So I apologize. There's no pipe dream that reaches my wish.
Dr. Cook, as always, great to have you. Thanks for taking the time for the program this afternoon.
Thank you so much, Evan.
That is Dr. Steve Cook, an associate professor of pediatrics at Golisano Children's Hospital. And before we close, I'm going to squeeze in an email for our dietitians. Tanil says, just a general question. I recently found out I need to have my gallbladder out due to a 10-millimeter-sized gallstone. I'm an otherwise healthy 39-year-old woman. When I asked the chief of gastroenterology at my appointment last week to refer me to a dietitian or nutritionist, she had to Google one. How is someone so involved with gut health not ready with information for people wanting to change their lifestyle and prevent further health issues? Also, if you know any dietitian or nutritionist that takes Blue Cross Blue Shield, I'm on the market.
I'll just say I'm sorry for that. And we're all out here. And it's eatright.org is the governing body. It's the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics that governs all the dietitians across the country. So you can find us there, RGH and URMC. We're here, and you can Google us there. Sounds like you need probably an outpatient dietitian. And right off the bat, with the gallbladder out, we need to think about fats. So just be mindful of that.
Eatright.org. To find what's available here and across the country. And there is a lot here. And good luck to you, Tanil. I'm really hopeful for you that there will be a good outcome here and that you're going to recover well. Thank you for taking the time to email. For all the listeners who took the time, hopefully you got a lot of good information this hour from Dr. Cook and Jill Chodak, a clinical dietitian with the Center for Community Health and Prevention at the University of Rochester Medical Center. As always, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Leslie Fisher, registered dietitian with Rochester Regional Health. Nice having you. Thank you
Thanks.
For being here.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Tim Shea, the ultimate volunteer today, doing everything back there but hosting the show. Maybe he'll host it next time. Emma Ray, behind the glass helping out. Great having you. Megan Mack is producing and engineering today because why not? She can do everything. And I will talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.